Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Capitalism and Its Discontents, featuring Richard D. Wolfe, Ann Feeney, The Texas Winter Storm Massacre, Irish Slavery, and, if time permits, The Potato Famine. I hope you'll stay tuned. Capitalism and Its Discontents, with apologies to Sigmund Freud. In an amazing coincidence, Freud published a book with a very similar title in 1930. How do you like that? We will take several looks at what our pundits insist on calling free enterprise. Here's a thing I find refreshing about Richard D. Wolfe. He's not afraid to use the C word. Not the four-letter C word, but the 10-letter C word, capitalism. Think about it for a minute. Capitalism is by far the most common and the most powerful economic system on Earth. And its epicenter is our very own country. Our entire national government is the handmaiden of this system, and the handmaiden of the oligarchs who own the system. Yet the name of the system is seldom written or spoken. Euphemisms abound. The thousands of American propagandists for capitalism sing the praises of what they call the American way of life, or the American economic system, or free enterprise, etc., etc. They almost never call it capitalism. Why is capitalism, so to speak, the economic system that dare not speak its name? We call other powerful forces, each by its name, democracy, Christianity, Islam. The majority of religious Americans will even speak the name of the God they worship. We all will speak the names of economic systems we are told do not work, socialism, communism. Yet the word capitalism seems to be taboo. Ask yourself when you last encountered the word in your local newspaper, or on TV, or on national public radio. Why is that? Here's my own take. Capitalism is not working for 99% of the American people. It works very well indeed for the 1% at the top. So the 1% want us to think of this failed system not as a constructed system, but as just a part of nature. As not worth thinking about, and certainly nothing anyone could ever change. To call something by its name implies that alternatives are viable. To call yourself a Methodist implies that another Christian could reasonably be a Unitarian, or a Baptist, or a Roman Catholic. Likewise, to call our economic system capitalism is to imply that alternative economic systems could be reasonable and valid, and, conceivably, even better. The capitalist oligarchs do not want your mind to start moving in that direction. Since they own the mass media and control the educational system, making the word capitalism practically taboo is an easy task for them. Economist Richard Wolfe is no fan of the current system, and he is not afraid to call capitalism capitalism. A few months back, we heard the first two-thirds of a good interview with Wolfe, conducted by the Canadian progressive activist Mexi. The discussion was titled, COVID-19 and the End of Capitalism. One key point Wolfe made there is this. A critical flaw of capitalism has always been its instability. For hundreds of years, it has always been crashing. Every 4 to 7 years, it crashes, plunging the host country into a recession or worse. 20 years into the 21st century, capitalism is crashing for the third time in the century, and we are heading for a major recession. Right on schedule. Don't blame COVID. That was just the trigger. As Wolf says this week, the system is the problem, and system change is the solution. But how? When? What to do? That's what Mexi and Wolf will explore in this final segment. Here they are.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, they may think that they can keep going for now, but I think that a lot of people are being radicalized by this moment. We're already seeing a number of wildcat strikes being organized on the ground. A lot more people are joining labor unions or unionizing their workplaces. And then, of course, there's this whole global uprising to defund and abolish the police, who are the protectors of private property and capitalism itself. So what are your thoughts on all of these developments? And what do you think that people should be doing to organize themselves right now to force a change?
Well, for me, these are all straws in the wind. I celebrate them. These are things I have hoped for. I felt we're missing. I am, you know, I'm pleased. I am satisfied. I'm inspired. And by the way, it all affects me too. I get invited to places I was never invited to before to speak. I have audiences I didn't know existed. And the level of enthusiasm is it's infectious. It keeps people like me going. We wouldn't be able to keep going or talk the way we do if it weren't for the feedback that we're basically getting from people who have figured most of this out in terms of their own lives and their own experiences. I do think there are two things I would point to that are, for me, the biggest stumbling blocks or the biggest tasks we face. One of them, and not necessarily the most important, but one of them is best captured by the word organization. Americans have been bitterly disappointed in organizations of all kinds. You know, we pride ourselves on being isolated loners. We celebrate the loner, the independent, the self-reliant, all of that. And some of that, you know, is good stuff. But others of it is kind of fantastical and make-believe. We do depend upon one another, whether we can face it or not. But the sad thing is that the left, and which is very numerous in this country and runs very, it's very deep. It's a wonderful community, but it fails to get itself together. It fails to organize. If you get interested in an issue, you have until recently been very focused. You want to work on that issue, and you don't want people who are focused on something else that's more important in their lives. And then you have these sterile debates. Who's got the most important issue? Are we oppressed mostly because we have our gender or our sexuality or our skin color or our education? Stop. This is a system that breaks people apart because it's terrified of the possibility of what might happen if an organization of the majority. And I'm an economist, so let me tell you what I think the root of that is. We have an economic system in which in every enterprise, factory, office, store, what do we have? A tiny group of people, the so-called owner of the enterprise, or the board of directors of the corporation, or the major shareholders, whatever you want. This is a tiny group of people, a small minority of all of those who work in that enterprise, in that factory, office, or store. That small group of people make all the key decisions. They decide what gets produced. They decide what technology is used. They decide where the production happens. And they decide what happens with the output. Do you sell it? Who do you sell it to? At what price? What do you do with any profit? All of those decisions are made by a minority. And they are told to the majority, who has to live with it and shut up. Because if you say something, they can also fire you, and then you lose your job and lose your income and lose your chance to advance in your life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is a horrible, undemocratic system. And I think it leads to a kind of passivity. It leads to a feeling I can't control anything. Because you know where you work. That's where you go 5 out of 7 days of the week. That's where you spend most of the waking hours of each of those 5 days. To imagine that that's not going to shape you in a basic way is naive. Of course it will. And it's difficult then to get yourself motivated to be an activist out of the workplace when the workplace is so structured to make you passive, to resign you, to make you accept, because what can you do? The notion I can't change the world starts in the workplace, if not earlier in your family, which often replicate. So I think overcoming this situation, being aware of it so that you can fight it, if the American left, even the size it is now, if it were organized, its impact on our society, its power would be 50 times what it is now. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders would have been the candidate, not Joe Biden, and so on, and so on, and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's the first. And the second one is, and I know being an academic, this may be hard to swallow, and maybe that's why I believe it. It does make sense to study and learn and to have a strategy and to have a theory about what's going on. Otherwise, you're helter-skelter every which way. Mm-hmm. Not that you have to believe the theory answers all the questions. No theory does. And if a theory pretends, don't pay attention to it. But a theory is a guide, a rough guide to what to do. And for me, the biggest thing right now is to understand that capitalism, the system, is the problem, that we are not going to fix it or improve it or perfect it or get rid of this or that impediment. We've been there. We've tried all of that. It doesn't work. That's why we're in the disaster we're in. And it's time to face, and this is a theoretical point, that the system is the problem and that system change is the solution. And that change has to happen in our personal relationships, in our workplaces, in our residences, all over the place. That's what system change means. I know it's scary, but not to change the system is proving to be scarier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you about, I guess, the end of capitalism, right? So I feel like even before COVID-19 hit, the contradictions of capitalism have never been so pronounced, right? Between, you know, decades of outsourcing and automation and the global environmental crisis, it seems like we just don't have anywhere else to go. However, capitalism just has always been so resilient and able to turn what would be externalities into, you know, new avenues for profit, et cetera. So do you see ways that capitalism can hold on despite these worsening contradictions? And do you see it living out the century?
Great questions. I just wish we had 50 hours more to work our way through. Look, I understand there's a joke that used to be made about Marxist economists. Mm-hmm. The joke went like this. Marxist economists have predicted 10 of the last 4 recessions. The answer being Marxists keep seeing the end of capitalism and it doesn't show up. Look, I'm not a predictor. I don't believe in prediction. I can't tell you when this system will disappear. But I don't feel I have to prove that it will. And here's the reason. Every system before capitalism displays the following pattern. It's born, it evolves over time, and then it dies and passes away. We had slavery, it was born, it developed, it died. We had feudalism, born, developed, died. We have capitalism, born, developed. What's the next step? For me, it's not a question of whether. It's a question of when and how. Mm-hmm. And I'm for the first time, because I haven't felt this way before, I am now looking at a system I don't see how it gets out of the dead end it has waltzed itself into. In this country in particular, Western Europe, North America, Japan, I think capitalism is exhausted here. Mm-hmm. Not in Brazil, not in India, not in China. They still have a ways to go because they were late to the party. But we were the early ones, and we, the capitalist initial parts of the world, we can't solve our problems anymore. That's what's showing up. We can't keep ourselves healthy. We can't prevent our forests from burning down. We cannot solve our racial difficulties. We cannot solve, you know, our misogynistic history. We can't deal with the problems that we have. And that's a sign of a system that's exhausted. And I see the signs around me. And so I'm beginning now to think in an ongoing way that we are in a declining system, which is difficult to face up to. It's hard to go through. The last century have seen the British people still unable to understand that their empire is over, acting as if they were something other than a small, cold, wet island off of the mainland of Europe. I mean, that's hard. I understand that. We're going to have the same difficulty. And I see Trump and the horrors of what he represents as a symptom of a declining system raging against the world. This morning, the World Trade Organization reached a conclusion that the tariffs Mr. Trump imposed on China are illegal, contrary to World Trade Organization, and have to stop. Mm-hmm. Look at that. There he was, Mr. Rageful, punishing the world with tariffs. All it did was unify the rest of the world against the United States. These are the ragings of a person who can't effectively accept that the game is coming to an end and we have to adjust to play a role in the world that is something other than King of the Hill that we believed before. That, I think, is the real challenge of how to manage this decline so it doesn't take us all down with it.
Economist Richard D. Wolff, in conversation with Mexi on September 15, 2020. The late labor lawyer, labor activist, and labor singer, Ann Feeney, was no great fan of capitalism either. Certainly not capitalism as it is practiced in the workplace. Anne died on February 3, 2021. I'm still processing that. As I speak, it's a month later. Now is the winter of our discontent, and I mean that literally. Temperatures in Connecticut are sub-freezing on March 2nd. Some of the snow from weeks ago still remains on the ground. I thought it would be good for us to hear the very rare Ann Feeney song that seems to have nothing to do with economic justice, workplace conflict, or politics. The song is called Winter Go Away. But I was just struck by one line of this song, which is, I wish I was in Texas. Ha! Those were the days. Shortly after Ann's death, an unusually frigid winter storm struck Texas. That was bad enough. Worse, a huge power outage followed. Texas's electric system is largely self-contained, largely dependent on fossil fuels, profit-driven, and not at all winterized, regardless of the cold spells that do hit Texas from time to time. This time, frigid temperatures impeded the flow of natural gas to the power plants. Also, many power plants themselves froze up and had to be shut down. Millions of Texans were plunged into frigid darkness. Texas Governor Greg Abbott went on TV and blamed the massive power failure on Texas's wind turbines, some of which indeed had frozen. He said that the huge power blackout shows the folly of the Green New Deal and the virtues of burning fossil fuels. That was a bit much, even for the corporate media, which noted that wind turbines generated only 10% of Texas's electricity. They noted that the fossil-fueled and nuclear 90% of the system had widespread failures itself. And the wind turbines, in fact, had a lower failure rate than the gas and coal-fueled plants. As his constituents were shivering in the dark, Texas's right-wing Senator Ted Cruz and family traveled to Cancun, Mexico, for a vacation. In mine humble opinion, this act is nothing compared to Cruz's other offenses against democracy and humanity. But the optics of the trip were not good. Cruz then blamed his departure on his two preteen daughters. Cherchez la femme. The death toll from the cold and blackout in Texas is still being tabulated. The final figure is not expected for several more weeks or months. One contemporary report put the total as 68 and counting, and the final number is expected to be substantially higher. That's what Ann Feeney would have focused on, had she lived to see it. Not the senator's Cancun antics, which is just symbolism, but the real deaths and sufferings of ordinary people in a state that values electric company profits more than public health. But Anne at least intended the song to be non-political. Here it is.
Oh, I've had it with this winter. I can't take another day. I'm sick of watching the world through a thousand shades of gray. There's not a single sign of life in these frozen empty trees. And this bitter cold has penetrated deep inside of me. I'm sick of shoveling and shivering, Jack Frost nipping at my nose. I'm tired of struggling with these heat bills and these layers and layers and layers of clothes. I want to toss away these scarves and gloves, burn these boots and overshoes, pull the covers over my head. I don't want to hear the news. Oh, it's record-breaking wind chills, pipes frozen, kids at home. The landscape looks like Labrador, Siberia, or Nome. The wind cuts like a sucker punch right to the solar plexus. Won't you tell me what I'm doing here when I could be in Texas? Under the ground, the crocuses remember. Will they keep their promise to arise? Are they struggling for the skies? Or will I ever feast my eyes upon their blossoms tender? Oh, give me daffodils and violets, iris and narcissus, tulips and forsythia and hyacinths. Oh, this is the mantra that I pray, and it gets me through the day. I hope those winter gods can hear and that they plan to disappear. I'm singing, winter go away, winter go away, winter go away. Winter go away, winter go away, winter go away.
St. Patrick's Day cometh, which reminds me, speaking of capitalism, did you know that 17th century English capitalism brought to the New World not only African slaves, but also Irish slaves? I'll read portions of an article by Josh Martin in Global Research, originally published in 2008. It's titled, The Irish Slave Trade. In the early 17th century, King James I of England and then Charles I led the effort to enslave the Irish. Then Oliver Cromwell continued the practice. The Irish slave trade began when James I sold 30,000 Irish prisoners as slaves to the New World. His proclamation of 1625 required Irish political prisoners be sold to English settlers in the West Indies. By the mid-1600s, the Irish were the main slaves sold to Antigua and Montserrat. At that time, 70% of the total population of Montserrat were Irish slaves. Ireland quickly became the biggest source of human livestock for English merchants. The majority of the early slaves sold to the New World were Irish. From 1641 to 1652, over 500,000 Irish were killed by the English, and another 300,000 were sold as slaves. Ireland's population fell from about 1,500,000 to 600,000 in a single decade. During the 1650s, over 100,000 Irish children between the ages of 10 and 14 were taken from their parents and sold as slaves in the West Indies, Virginia, and New England. In this decade, 52,000 Irish, mostly women and children, were sold to Barbados and Virginia. Another 30,000 Irish men and women were also transported and sold to the highest bidder. In 1656, Cromwell ordered that 2,000 Irish children be taken to Jamaica and sold as slaves to English settlers. Many people today avoid calling the Irish slaves slaves. They use terms like indentured servants. However, in most cases from the 17th and 18th century, Irish slaves were nothing more than human cattle. During this period, the African slave trade was just beginning. African slaves were not tainted by the hated stain of Catholicism and were more expensive to purchase, so they were often treated far better than the Irish slaves. The English masters began copulating with the Irish women for both pleasure and profit. Children of slaves were themselves slaves, which increased the size of the master's unpaid workforce. Even if an Irish woman somehow attained her freedom, her children would remain the property of her master. In time, the English thought of a better way to use these women. The settlers began to breed Irish women and girls with African men to produce so-called mulatto slaves. Mulattoes brought a higher price than the white Irish, and they saved the planters the cost of purchasing expensive new Africans. This interbreeding became so widespread that in 1861 a law was passed prohibiting it, because it was hurting the profits of a powerful slave transport company. England continued to ship tens of thousands of Irish slaves for more than a century. In 1839, Britain finally outlawed the transporting of slaves. The new law slowly concluded this chapter of nightmarish Irish misery. And on that sobering note, I must bid you adieu. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, bidding you illegitimi non carborundum and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.